The cost of bringing you the programs that you depend on are increasing. They keep going up all the time. And the only way that we can maintain the same level of service is if people like you who listen and appreciate the programs are willing to pay part of the cost. We hope that you will call us this morning. You could do that. In fact, you do that right now if you like, and make a financial contribution to WILL. If you have been a supporter in the past, we thank you. We hope that we can rely on your continuing support. But for whatever reason, if you've been a listener and you haven't made a contribution, now is the great time to sign on. You can call us at 244-9455. Or if you'd like, you can give online. We have a new pledge address this time around. That is willpledge.org. So that's just willpledge.org. You can do it that way, or you can do it the more traditional way by giving us a call. Whatever way you do it, we just want to make sure that you understand your support, your financial support, is very important to this station because you are helping to pay the cost of the programs that you depend on. So hope that, again, you'll put that on your list of things to do today. Call in and make a pledge. As I mentioned in this part of Focus 580, we'll be talking about cotton, and our guest for the show is Stephen Yaffa. He is the author of a book that came out earlier this year. It's titled Big Cotton, How a Humble Fiber Created Fortunes, Wrecked Civilizations, and Put America on the Map. We talked with him when this book just first came out. It was published by Viking. Talked with him by telephone, and he is now visiting the campus to talk about this very subject, and we're pleased that we can spend some more time talking with him. He is a novelist, a playwright, a video producer, an award-winning screenwriter. He's written for many different publications. This is his first nonfiction book, and it's a fascinating story because it talks about cotton, where it comes from, how it's used, how it's processed. It talks about what it's meant to American history, to the American economy. I think that the chapter on denim all by itself is worth the price of the book. It's really a fascinating story. And it gets into issues of the global economy. It gets into issues of the environment. It covers a lot of ground. So we're really pleased that he could be here. Maybe one more thing here. I'll give our telephone numbers. Those, if you want to call into the show, same as always, 333-9455. We also have a toll-free line that's good anywhere you can hear us, and that is 800-222-9455. Well, thanks very much.
Thank you, David, and thank you for inviting me back.
As we discussed here a little bit before we got going, I thought we could try to get into some areas that perhaps we had touched on when we talked before, but we could get into some greater depth, maybe just as a general kind of question, as a way of getting going. What got you interested? This seems to be a little different than the other kinds of things that you've done in your professional writing career. What got you interested in writing about cotton?
It's a good question. I backed into this subject knowing I thought it initially absolutely nothing about it, and then finding that I did have a connection to it, which became a little more obvious when I started to do a little research. But the way that I got into this had to do with writing a catalog copy for my wife's catalog, Viva Terra, which combines high style, really, in terms of the quality of the home furnishings that are in the catalog with ecology, so that you're really looking at eco plus style, and those two things don't often coexist. Mm-hmm. And so in order to do that and have some sense that I knew what I was writing about, when she started to do items made out of organic cotton, I said to her, name is Bonnie, "Bonnie, what is organic cotton? And why is anybody doing organic cotton? It's not cotton. It's not something we eat. What's the point?" And she said, "Well, Stephen, why don't you talk to a couple of organic cotton growers around Lubbock, Texas, whom we're getting some of our products from, and they're going to talk to you a little bit about the environmental damage that cotton does." And that's where this began. And I did some research on that and talked to a wonderful woman named Lorea Pepper, who has a organic cotton cooperative outside of Lubbock, Texas, and she's a grower, and her father-in-law died at an early age in the cotton fields, and there are cotton widows around Lubbock, Texas, and they're called cotton widows because their husbands died because of leukemia and various forms of cancer, but particularly leukemia, attributed by them very directly to the amount of pesticides that they had been inhaling and toxins they'd been inhaling for 20 or 30 years out in the fields. And one thing led to another, and I said to my agent in New York, there might be an interesting subject here, which is that cotton, the fabric of our lives, may very well be for many people the fabric of their deaths. Mm-hmm. And her name is Charlotte. She's a wonderful woman. Charlotte Sheedy said to me, "Well, Stephen, nobody wants to read a book about how bad cotton is for you. Why don't you write a broader social history and include that information in there?" And that led me to thinking about, okay, what is my relationship to this subject? I don't really know much about it. And then it sort of popped into my head in the next few minutes that I actually grew up in Lowell, Massachusetts, which was the center of the Industrial Revolution in the United States. And the reason that it was the center of the Industrial Revolution had 100% to do with cotton. It was where the first cotton factories grew up in the United States and changed the way that America dealt with the world and the world dealt with America.
Yeah. Maybe we could talk a little bit more about environmental impact of cotton production, as one of the things that you write about, and one of the things that is true is that cotton, of all of the various kinds of agricultural crops that are produced around the world, cotton is one of the biggest consumers of chemical pesticides. And not only does that have environmental impact on the people who are on the growers, the people who have to work with that, but it also has a broader impact on the environment. The land, that is, where the cotton is grown, and then the land around there where the cotton is grown.
The land, the air, the water, people's health. You know, this is a situation that is actually beginning to improve because of GMO, and we can talk a little bit about that. But for most of the 20th century, or really almost all of the 20th century, cotton created huge amounts of environmental devastation. And it wasn't as if farmers were out to pollute the land. Farmers know more about their relationship to the land than any of us because they have to go out and work it. The problem was, and also make a living from it. So it wasn't wanton destructive. The problem is that cotton is like the perfect crop to invite insects of all sorts. It provides a really kind of warm, snuggly home inside the cotton bowl, which is about the size of a walnut, where the fibers grow for all manner of worms, and particularly for the boll weevil. And it was to eradicate these insects, and it's still going on, by the way, that these chemicals began to be used. The problem was that nature has a funny way of, as somebody said to me when I was writing the book, of jumping up and biting us in the butt, which is that as soon as we feel that we have conquered it, nature, in terms of mutations of insects, finds a way to sort of do an end run around us. And that's essentially what happened. So more and more chemicals kept being applied in greater and greater quantities. And the devastation came from the quantity of these toxin chemicals, malathion in particular, that are being used.
Mm-hmm. And it is to some extent a problem here in the United States. There are places around the world where it's even worse.
Yes. In fact, 90% of cotton workers in the fields of India come down with some kind of respiratory or environmentally caused disease, and it's directly related to the pesticides.
Yeah. There has been now for some years a fair amount of controversy about genetically modified organisms, the GMOs. And here, certainly in this part of the country, we're used to hearing about genetically modified corn and soybeans. And there are plants that are genetically modified to resist herbicide so that you can spray your entire field with herbicide. Weeds die. Plants don't. There are also plants that are genetically modified to produce internally an insecticide, Bacillus thuringiensis, which it comes in different varieties that are targeted to different insects. And we also know there's corn, for example, corn plants that produce BT. So the insects come along, they eat the corn plant, they eat the BT, they die. And that is good because then or some people would argue it's good because then, well, you spray less pesticide and you don't have the environmental impact. At the same time, there are questions raised about is that a good thing or not? Is there any potential impact on human health of that plant? And I think so far the answer is no, but maybe we're not completely sure. And farmers, I think, find themselves in a really difficult position because on the one hand, people are saying, we'd really like it if you would use less herbicide and pesticide. And then also people say, but on the other hand, we'd also like you to be organic. We don't want you to use GM crops. And the farmers sort of say, now, okay, now what is it you want? You're putting us in a position where no matter whatever we do, somebody's going to be saying, no, we're really unhappy. And all of those same things that apply to corn and soybeans also apply to cotton.
I think you're making really several extremely good points there, David, which is that farmers are caught in a very difficult situation. And it's exacerbated by the fact that farming is basically not a very lucrative way of existing in the United States any longer for reasons that we all know about. So there's that double, triple whammy as well, which means that, you know, as these pesticides get more and more virulent, they also get more and more expensive and so forth. And so there's this GMO seems to be in many ways one of the factors that can reduce the actual cost of producing cotton, and I'm sure it's true for soy and corn as well. The initial cost of the seeds from Monsanto for cotton are higher, and you can't go back and replant those seeds. You have to buy them every year from Monsanto, so you're on a lease program to the company. But the good news in terms of cost is that you wind up, instead of doing a crop dusting spraying maybe 15 to 20 times a year in terms of controlling the insects, particularly bollworms and pinkworms these days for cotton, you wind up doing it maybe 3 or 4 times a year. And that's a huge savings. And the reason for that is that BT, which you just described, which actually is an organic pesticide, is now in the code of the DNA, so that the interior of the plant, which was so welcoming to all of these bugs, no longer is welcoming, and so it's really been very effective. I think the problem in terms of reducing the pesticide use, the problem that a lot of people have with this, and you know, I'm not sure I'm one of them at this point, but is the problem in the United States of in particular is the problem of drift, which is that, you know, you're still applying these in a way that may very well start to contaminate fields that aren't GMO fields, and you're sort of, you know, it's the problem of are you really being able to monitor the situation sufficiently to be able to create the conditions that won't create more problems in the future. I think that's, you know, that's a legitimate problem, but, you know, you get activists involved on both sides, and you know, it's like one of those ridiculous programs on Fox TV where people are screaming at each other, or Hardball, you know, and nothing comes out of that except more of the same kind of, you know, anger and rhetoric in both ways. So it's not a very, you know, illuminating kind of discussion often.
How much now of the cotton planted around the world is GM cotton?
In our country, about 70 to 80% in our country. 80%, the shirt you're wearing, the Levi's that I'm wearing, definitely a GMO. China will be all GMO within 3 or 4 years, maybe 5 years at the most, for some of the reasons we're talking about. You know, the cost of doing this is essentially higher, but then it is lower in the long run. Mm-hmm. And the problems that you run into with GMO really don't have to do with this country as much as when you get to a country like India in particular, which grows a huge amount of cotton, which has literally no regulations it has governmental regulations, but in practical terms, there's no regulation on the kind of seeds that are being planted in cotton, because a lot of these seeds are bought out of the trunk of a car. Guy drives up, he's got, you know, GMO seeds. The farmer needs whatever help he can get. He's making, if he's lucky, $2,000 a year to support 40 or 50 people in an extended family. You know, he's trying to counter a huge amount of insects. He doesn't know whether the GMO in this particular plant, these seeds are targeted toward those specific insects or not, but he's hearing that they are. So you've got this huge unregulated mass of cotton farmers, you know, millions of them, really, and very little governmental monitoring.
Mm-hmm. One of the concerns that has been raised, and it's been, I'm sure it's raised about the GM cotton as well as corn and soybeans, people say, well, what you're really doing, you're setting up an ideal experiment to test natural selection, and that if we're not careful, that what will happen, for example, if we're talking about cotton, we have cotton that has some variety of BT in there that will kill these pests that attack cotton. We should expect, if we plant everything with that kind of cotton, that it won't be very long before we find the insects,
the super insects,
that are resistant to that. And of course, the industry says, well, we have some way to deal with that by creating reservoirs in the
That's
field
right.
that are not resistant. So we figure that will take care of it. But I think that there's still some concern about, over the long run, over time, are we going to get to a point where Bacillus thuringiensis isn't going to work anymore because we have bred insects that are resistant?
If you look back at the history of anything that has to do with man's trying to control nature, and cotton is only one of hundreds of examples, the issues that you're bringing up now are totally relevant to an ongoing adversarial relationship in many ways between us and nature, which is also, you know, extraordinarily friendly in other ways. But the adversarial part of it is that nature has ways of ultimately winning battles that we think we've won. And I think what you're describing here, you know, if you look at history, it suggests that this is only going to happen again, and that as shrewd as we are, we're not as shrewd as we think we are. So there's a kind of a false sense of security that often creeps in here. And I'm not suggesting that all the GMO experiments going on in the world are going to collapse around us, and I'm sure you're not either. But I don't think in terms of being forward-thinking, in terms of preventing possible problems, we're as adept as we are at, you know, going out and using what we've got to the best of our abilities at the moment. And I'm very concerned about that because I don't really feel that we pay as much attention as we seem to be, you know, suggesting that we are to the potential for damage.
We have a caller here. Let's talk with him. Champaign County, line one. Hello.
You mentioned the cotton farmers in India. There's actually a very tragic situation going on. I've heard that thousands have committed suicide because they're into this high-input GM cotton, and it just hasn't produced the way they expected. And I've heard about it mainly through Vandana Shiva, who was a trained physicist from Iowa State, I think, but she's one of the bigger campaigners about GM food in the world, and I think she knows her stuff. But I wanted to mention this biological concept of lysergy. It's what GM people use to, researchers use to transfer. They use viruses to transfer genes around it. Well, it's actually a natural phenomenon, too. So once one starts placing genetic code and changing it around, you know, it as you say, it doesn't just drift, it gets propagated in some ways. It can. There's a, you know, mathematical possibility of that. And just the unintended consequences are just so frightening, actually. I don't know how much of that you agree with, but I think this idea that, you know, we can fix something and change it, and then it's, you know, we don't have to worry about the unintended consequences when Monsanto is mainly worried about their quarterly report as opposed to what's going to happen in 10 years from now with the implications of what they've been doing.
Yeah, you want to talk about that?
I do. Thank you for that call. I do talk about her in my book, Ms. Shiva, and I also talk a little bit about that suicide that you're talking about, that there were 600-700 people who committed suicide in a province in India for exactly that reason, which is that the seeds did not perform as they promised, and they kept getting further and further in debt, and they wound up actually drinking the pesticides. You know, it's as horrible as it sounds. It's true, and it's one of the really not very well publicized effects. And it wasn't only about GMO at that time, by the way, but certainly the issues that you're bringing up about Monsanto, from a lot of people's point of view, you know, this is essentially greed, really trumping in intelligent concern. And I'm not sure that's entirely true. I mean, it's very easy to find, you know, villains in this story, and I think that to some extent there needs to be a little bit more of a kind of objective dialogue about what is being done, what could be done, because these are such emotional issues. They tend to, you know, for me as well, create a lot of passion, and passion can sometimes get in the way of clear thinking. I think that, you know, Monsanto is to some extent probably doing stuff in the world without the kind of controls that are necessary, but I don't think it's quite that simple. So we're really at the beginning of a long dialogue that I think needs to happen in an environment where there's more clarity than smoke.
We're talking this morning in this first hour of Focus 580 with Stephen Yaffa. His book is titled Big Cotton: How a Humble Fiber Created Fortunes wrecked civilizations and put America on the map. It was just published at the beginning of the year by Viking. He's visiting the campus of the University of Illinois. He'll be giving two talks that are free and open to anyone who would like to attend. And in a moment here, I'll tell you when and where. And we'll continue to take calls from people who are listening. We do need to just also pause for a moment here to remind folks who are listening that support, financial support for this radio station is very important. We do this program 2 hours every weekday morning throughout the year. And the only time that we interrupt the conversation at all, just a couple of times a year, is times like this, where we're asking people for financial support. Otherwise, we go straight through. And one of the things that I really appreciate about doing the show on this station is that I don't have to take breaks. I can have long, extended conversations with guests. But the only reason that that's possible is that people who listen are also financial supporters. They help pay the bills. So we don't have commercials on this station. Now is one of those times we ask people for their support. You can call us at 244-9455. We'd like to check in with David Teal. He is program director of our companion television station, WILL-TV. He is in Pledge Central, and we want to make sure that people know that we have some incentives to encourage them to make a contribution, and one of those is a challenge for listeners during Focus 580.
That's right. We've got a challenge specific to Focus 580 this morning. We have a couple in Champaign who will add $25 to each pledge during Focus, up to 10 pledges. So the first 10 pledges that come in during Focus, an extra $25 for each of those, obviously $250 on the line there. We have a second challenge. It's not specific to Focus, but we'd love to be able to retire this right away as well. Bert Gray from Decatur will give $20 per new member this morning, again, up to a total of 10, so another $200 on the line. So if you have not made a contribution before, this would be an excellent time to get on board, because not only would it satisfy the one challenge, it would satisfy the other challenge as well. It's extra $45 there. One more incentive. If you are a new friend, you've never made a pledge before to WILL Radio, we will mail you this morning. You can qualify to have mailed to you a $10 gift certificate courtesy of World Harvest Foods. They want to encourage our listeners to become supporters. And so if you've never made a pledge, call 217-244-9455, become a new friend, get that $10 gift certificate, and then, of course, an extra $45 tacked on to your pledge when you call. But we want to retire, if nothing else, we want to retire this Focus challenge. This is the one with a time limit.
Yeah, that'd be great. And that will help us to make that overall goal we've set for ourselves, $160,000. And that's just this week. The goal for the year is much bigger, but that's just this week. And we, again, want to remind people that your financial contributions, listener contributions from individuals and families, now are getting close to making up half of the money, 47% to be precise, half of the money that it takes to run the station. The other sources over time have shrunk. And the only place that we can go to make up the difference, because the costs of running the station continue to go up, the only place we can go to make up that difference is to listeners. We hope that you will give, and give generously, particularly if you've been listening for a while and you have never given before. 244-9455 is the number to call. That will take a minute or two to take care of that. You also are welcome to pledge online at our website at willpledge.org. Thank you, Dave. We'll check
back
with you later, and we will continue our conversation with Stephen Yaffa. As I mentioned at the beginning of the program, he is a novelist, a playwright, video producer, screenwriter. His first nonfiction book, the book that we have mentioned a couple of times here, is Big Cotton, published by Viking. And it's a fascinating book. So you might seek it out, bookstore, library. For people who are in and around Champaign-Urbana, Stephen Yaffa will be giving two talks on the U of I campus. And anyone who is interested in attending should feel welcome. They're free, open to the public. He'll be talking about the book, Riding Big Cotton, at noon in room 219 in Davenport Hall, sponsored in part by the folks at the Geography Department. And then also he'll be giving a talk at 4 o'clock this afternoon in Follinger Auditorium on the campus, again, talking about Big Cotton. His visit here is sponsored in part by the U of I Global Studies Initiative. So, again, if you're here around Champaign-Urbana, you'd like to hear more from him, you can head down there. Otherwise, you can look for the book. 333-9455. That's the Champaign-Urbana number here if you'd like to call into the show with a question. A toll-free 800-222-9455. We have another caller here on our toll-free line. I'm not sure where calling from. We'll go there, line four. Hello.
Good old Indiana.
Yeah, okay. Well, welcome.
Two questions. You just mentioned that now is the time to start a dialogue. Well, why don't you say something in a more general sense, particularly about positions the corporate industry is taking on this problem, even if they call it a problem. And I guess secondly, have there been any instances that are since provable, whatever connotation you want to put on that, of similar incidents happening in the United States where, as you mentioned in India, I'm not talking about suicides, but I'm talking about relative increase in certain pulmonary diseases and things like that that can be just on the lowest level, you know, they have a correlation, whether or not it meets somebody's number or not, or what that correlation is, that things aren't alright in the farming community when using these more potent pesticides, herbicides, you know, all sides. When do they start, you know, moving into the homicide kind of aspect of things? Thanks.
Okay. Well, can you...
Thank you for those questions. Let me address the second one. The first one, which has to do with opening a dialogue for corporations, I think it would be a terrific idea. I'm not sure whom beyond Monsanto would get involved with that at this point in the United States, since they really do control all the GMO seeds, pretty much control all the GMO seeds that are being developed. Let me get into the second part of that and tell you that from the research that I did, there are studies and which really center on California, which, by the way, is the second largest cotton producer in the United States after Texas. There have been studies done about the field workers in particular in terms of their disease and the relationship of that to cotton pesticides, and that for a long time the disease rate in the fields of the San Joaquin Valley, Central Valley in California were much higher than for other kinds of farming where pesticides were not used. And so a lot of the local clinics were working very hard to try to figure out ways to combat that. And really, it was the reduction of the pesticides that led to improved health.
Hmm. You talked a little bit in the first segment of the program about the fact that there seems to be some increasing interest on the part of consumers and also on the part of people who make things out of cotton, increasing interest in organic product and different kinds of more natural cottons. There are also, interestingly enough, there are some – all cotton is not white. There are some cotton that naturally comes in colors, so you don't have to dye it, which I think is kind of interesting. But increasingly now, people know, if they look at catalogs, they go into stores, there are more and more things made out of cotton being offered that are made out of organic cotton. And I'm wondering what anybody thinks is the potential market for organic products that are made out of organically grown cotton.
I think that the market, which is a small market, seems to be growing at about 40% a year, which sounds like a huge increase, and in many ways it is. But when you think about the amount of organic cotton being grown in the world relative to the amount of conventional cotton, it's less than 1%. You know, not totally insignificant, but obviously a tiny fraction of all the cotton. One of the reasons that it's growing in countries like Europe in particular, the countries of Europe and in the United States, is that, you know, this is a process of education. It doesn't mean we always have to walk around in things that are environmentally pure. It simply means that as education improves and we get more awareness of the ultimate consequences of what we're up to in the world, we start to see that it's not just simply about putting on my blue jeans or my shirt. It might very well have to do as well with, the long-term environmental impact of all of this. And so it's really a process of education. And when you go certainly to the countries like Germany, France, and England, you find a lot more environmental awareness in many ways about the long-term consequences. And that's where organic cotton, particularly in Switzerland, by the way, seems to have found a really much larger audience in recent years than it had in the past. Mm-hmm. And in the United States, there are companies like Gaiam that are able to produce and sell organic cotton. There is always going to be a premium for it, but it's not outrageously expensive now compared to conventional cotton. And people who care about wearing or using organic cotton, who might be studying yoga and so forth, things that might be more related to it, are paying a lot more attention to organic cotton than in the past. I don't think it's ever, you know, going to turn out to be anywhere, certainly within the next 5 years, as strong an influence as Whole Foods, organic foods. But it does have some values, certainly beyond the environmental values. It's often softer after a long time away. Certainly new mothers who are interested only in having pure products around their newborns are very much drawn to organic cotton.
Mm-hmm. Okay, let's talk with someone in Champaign here. This is line number one.
Hello.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
This may be outside of your study or book, but I've been told that most cotton is treated with formaldehyde. And my son is allergic to a lot of clothes. And one of the suspicions is that perhaps he's allergic to formaldehyde. Do you know anything about that?
I do know a little bit about it. You know, and a little knowledge is a dangerous thing. So keep that in mind when I answer your question. Yes, formaldehyde has been used for a long time in the finishing of cotton, not exclusively by any means, but it's one of the chemicals that's been used in relatively, you know, a mild form. And I think it's easy enough to avoid. If you are concerned about that, then this conversation we're having about organic cotton would be really pertinent to you, because it is not used in the finishing of organic cotton. We talk about the chemicals used in growing cotton, and we really haven't mentioned, and I'm glad you brought it up, that a lot of the inorganic chemicals that are used in cotton are used in the finishing process, because you're essentially taking a crop that comes in, which if you look at a natural cotton, it's kind of either grayish or yellow. It's called grease, and it's not at all like the white bleached cotton that we walk around in thinking that, oh, this is the whitest crop on earth. This is not true. It doesn't come in that way at all. And so in order to go through all the steps involved in making it acceptable to absorb dyes and to become bleached in many ways and all the rest of the things that need to be done, an awful lot of chemicals are used in the finishing process. So I would recommend for sure in the situation you're talking about that you check out organic cotton sources.
Oh, thank you.
You're welcome.
Thank you. Other questions are welcome. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. Another big subject that I want to at least have you talk a little bit about is cotton as a global commodity. And as you've mentioned, there are some countries that produce enormous amounts of it. India produces a huge amount of cotton. China, it does, and is likely to produce more. United States produces a lot of cotton. But then there are also many smaller countries where people produce cotton, where it is one of the few or maybe the only thing that they can export. So it's a very for small farmers, it is a very important source of income for them. But apparently in places like that, it is becoming increasingly difficult for them to compete with farmers in bigger countries, particularly countries where there are subsidies, there are price supports for the product.
This brings up an interesting point, David, which is for me as a writer, you know, looking at a subject like cotton, which I have to say when I started thinking about it initially was like, yeah, well, it's a fabric. It's, you know, who cares? But it turns out that cotton is a perfect representation of so much that's going on in the world these days that goes far beyond this particular fabric. It deals with the relationship of one country to another. It deals with America's place in the global community, which is really what I'm going to be talking about later today. Hmm. And as a representation of that, it's really an eye-opener. After the publication, actually even before the publication of Big Cotton, when reviewers' copies were around last fall, a man from Oxfam, the international agency whose mission is to end poverty in the world, picked up a copy of my book in a used bookstore. It had already been dumped by one of the reviewers. He picks it up and he looks at it. And sure enough, there's a chapter at the end of my book, which is called Fields of Conflict. It's all about the way that American cotton subsidies have had a direct adverse effect on smaller countries in West Africa in particular. And he calls me up, and the next thing I know, I'm part of a delegation of eminent American citizens, including the vice president of the World Bank and Mary Robinson, the former president of Ireland, a wonderful woman. And off we go to Mali. And Mali is the fourth poorest country on earth. Mali's cotton competes directly with American cotton. And this was a really fascinating experience for me, but it was one of the representations of the way that cotton really goes far beyond being something that is either, you know, in the food that we eat as cottonseed oil or on our backs as apparel, into international politics, into the way that one country relates to another. Here we are trying to end the conditions that, or at least ameliorate the conditions that lead to terrorism by reducing poverty in countries, which is a perfect breeding ground, Mali in particular, the Muslim country, a friend of the United States, at the same time that the American cotton that we're putting on the market really is destroying the economy of this country, which is based entirely on cotton. So it's a very complex situation, one that I found, you know, painfully interesting.
Well, and it's also here, particularly in this country, is politically charged because it gives people who have concerns about price supports for agricultural commodities something to use as a what they would feel would be an egregious case study of why it's a problem. And in fact, you point out in the book that some attention to this, the Wall Street Journal gave some attention to this because their political orientation is, well, we're not really quite so sure about agricultural subsidies. And here's a particular, you know, they, in the words of the paper, they're saying here's a particularly bad example. And they, in fact, set sort of side by side the kinds of people to talk about, American cotton farmers and what their economics are and the amount of money that they get from the government and so forth, set against a farmer, a third world farmer who is just trying to basically subsist to make enough to live on and can't compete against cotton that ends up being dumped on the world market. There's no way that they can produce it any cheaper than that. And so that it's very clear that in the eyes of the paper and the eyes of some people, that, well, there's good guys here and there's bad guys here, and we're on the side of the bad guys because of our government policy that supports our farmers. And at the same time, you want to say, well, we'd like to see American cotton farmers prosper and do well and stay in business. We don't want them to go out of business. We want them to get a fair return on their investment. But then the question is, okay, well, what would be appropriate? You know, how much is enough? How much is okay? Do we want to support the price? To what extent? And do we care if farmers in Mali are starving because we're supporting our own farmers?
I think, you know, these are the issues that have to be raised. And you know, they're sensitive enough so that the New York Times and the Wall Street Journal both basically come together here in terms of their attitude toward what you're talking about, which is that our American cotton subsidies are totally out of line. So when you see two papers with totally different philosophies, one being extremely conservative, the Wall Street Journal, one being liberal, you know that there's an issue at stake. And the issue isn't so much about whether or not America should support cotton farmers with subsidies. It's the extent to which we should support them, the amount of money that we're giving to American cotton farmers, about 25,000. So, you know, when an American cotton farmer hears that this debate is going on, they immediately feel like everybody's sort of piling up against them and they don't understand. And I may be one of those people, but I've been down the Mississippi Delta and I've talked to a lot of these farmers, so I'm not looking at this from a distance. I've been to Mali. I feel that I have firsthand information about this. If I'm certainly not the world's leading authority, but I've been there. And one of the things that I found is that when you're talking about American cotton subsidies, you're talking about giving $512,000 per person to the top 12 to 15% of the cotton growers in the United States who get about 80% of all the subsidies. That's over $3 billion in the last farm bill. That is a huge amount of money. So that leads to what's called precision agriculture, which is a wonderful technological advance where planes fly overhead. They take images of the cotton fields, 10,000-acre cotton fields. They're downloaded on cards to the cabs of the tractors, of the harvesters, of the seed planters. And every plant is treated individually by the magic of technology on that field. Well, there's a guy growing cotton that's competing with that in Mali who's family is growing 6 acres of cotton, being picked by hand exactly as slaves picked in the Civil War, with no technology, not even a tractor around. So the inequities have to do really with, you know, the consequences of that kind of disparity. These people are actually now in Mali, Burkina Faso, and Benin, West Africa, exports a lot of cotton, but they do it all by hand, and it is costing these farmers more to do that than it costs them. They lose money because it's less profitable to produce it than it is to grow it. So basically what happens is that if you're getting less money and you're in Mali for the cotton that you've produced, what happens is that the dollar a day that you normally would be making, if you're lucky, you're no longer making, which means that you can't send your kids to school because you have to ultimately pay $2 a month for that school, and so forth and so on. So it's not just an economic disparity. As I mentioned earlier, the world we live in is a global village. You can't just do something in one country without affecting all sorts of countries, and those countries can't do something without affecting you. Look at China right now. China, you know, the end of quotas on textiles. So these textiles are flooding the United States. We're no longer manufacturing our own textiles. What do we do with all this cotton? Well, we send it to China. So in a sense, we're sort of feeding the enemy. I mean, it's a very complex world. And, you know, cotton is just one representation of how complicated that is. But I think a sensitivity is what's really all, this is all about. You know, not just assuming we're masters of the universe any longer and we can go about our business, you know, in an insular, isolated way. I think it's a change of perception that's needed.
Yeah. We have a caller here we'll get to right in a second. Let me just introduce once again our guest, Stephen Yaffa. He's the author of the book Big Cotton, How a Humble Fiber Created Fortunes, Wrecked Civilizations, and Put America on the Map. Came out earlier this year, published by Viking. He's here visiting the campus. We'll give a couple of talks. And again, before the end of the show, I'll tell you when and where. We have a caller here in Champaign to talk with. It's line one. Hello.
I had a question that may be a little bit outside the focus of the guest, but I'm wondering if any fibers, and I'm thinking of flax and hemp, are competing with cotton in the market. They seem like they might be able to be grown with less chemicals and water, and I'm just wondering if any enterprising farmers are starting to compete with these fibers against cotton.
Good question. Hemp can't be grown in the United States, at least unless the rules have changed in the last 25 minutes because of its connection to marijuana.
You How about
know?
Flax?
But flax, linen has, you know, flax, by the way, is the crop that leads that linen is made from. Yes, there's a market for linen. Linen, you know, in terms of its environmental impact, has much less environmental impact and is really much more ecologically sound in many ways than cotton. But cotton is and this is what my book really is about. Cotton is one of those things that is so versatile, that is so inexpensive, and so forth and so on, that all of its power derives from the fact that it sort of slips in under the radar. So the percentage of linen to cotton, you know, relatively speaking, is minuscule, and it's more expensive. It's, you know, it's got attributes that make it extremely appealing for a variety of uses. But it really doesn't begin to compete with cotton. And just to give you a sense of what I'm talking about, every moment on Earth, all 6.5 billion of us who live on this planet are either using or wearing something made out of cotton. And when you start thinking about that, that is a lot of power. And, you know, no other cash crop comes even close to that.
Okay, thank you. Okay. And one more point. Mm-hmm. It just seems to me that linen is a stronger fiber. It's just from my observation. So I just will throw that in, and thank you very much.
Oh, yeah. I love linen, by the way. I have nothing against any of these crops. I'm just talking about it in terms of you know, the amount of it, how ubiquitous it might be.
Yeah. The hemp story is really interesting, too. The fact that there are some countries where they have big industrial hemp industries, and it can be grown profitably. Farmers grow it, made into a variety of products. And there are varieties of hemp. There are plenty of varieties of hemp that don't have any of the intoxicant chemical that people smoke marijuana for. And I know that some people here in the United States argue that that would be good for American farmers to have that as an option. But somehow our attitude, our drug attitudes in this country, we can't seem to get around that fact.
You know, hemp has a variety of uses, David, as you're talking about, and could turn out to be an extremely valuable crop for the United States. But you have to overcome these prejudices, which, by the way, are a century old.
Yeah, there's just this fear that somehow we're going to have this big field of industrial hemp, and somehow in the middle of it, somebody's going to be growing marijuana, which somehow doesn't make it. You know, somehow in Canada, industrial hemp is a fairly significant product.
That's
they
right.
somehow managed to have figured out how to deal with it. So maybe we will someday. See if we can get one more caller in here. Sullivan is the town, line 4, toll-free line.
Yeah. How are you?
Yes, good.
I got a kind of a bone to pick here. You know, it seems like, shall we say, I farm, and I went to the farm show up there at Decatur or wherever it was, I don't recall. And anyway, there was a combine there, $250,000. That's no head, so you'll put a head, two heads on it. That's $400,000. And a tractor, 550 horsepower tractor, International, was $250,000 too. Now, how in the world am I supposed to buy something like that and deal with a world economic situation where some guy is over here picking cotton by hand and things like that? And I do believe a cotton harvester is one of the highest prices pieces of machinery that a person has to buy due to the spindles and whatever. And this idea, everybody works for free. I mean, if this is true, and I work for $6 an hour or whatever the saw over in Africa or whatever works for, we'll say $1 a day, do you folks want to work for $1 a day? You know, if you're going to downsize everybody's economy to scale, you know, I mean, right down to zero, make everybody the same throughout the country, it sucks. Why work?
Well, I think you've put your finger on a central problem, and I hope that nobody listening to this thinks that I'm advocating that farmers in the United States, first of all, are no longer important, or that they wind up working like yourself, you know, so that you're actually at the end of the day not making any money. I think the argument being made is that for a lot of farmers, the subsidies might be a little bit extravagant relative to other kinds of crops grown in the United States. You know, cotton farmers, because of the power of the cotton lobby, often seem to be in the public perception the top cotton growers who have really the agribusinesses are making an awful lot of money. So I think that the problem really is to create more equity within the cotton growing community so that farmers like yourself who might not be in that realm wind up being able to afford the machinery that is needed, and it is very expensive machinery, to come out ahead at the end of the day, but also not to be so extravagant in giving the top cotton growers so much money that it doesn't really leave enough to make it equitable up and down the line. So I don't think there's any easy answer to this, and I'm not suggesting that there is. And I don't think that anybody who looks at the situation would feel that, you know, we should just give up the ghost in order to make ourselves a more equitable player in the world.
We're going to have to stop because we've come to the end of the time. If you're here in and around Champaign-Urbana, there are two more opportunities for you to hear more from this morning's guest, Stephen Yaffa. I'll be talking at noon in room 214 of Davenport Hall, and also then at 4 o'clock in the Follinger Auditorium on the U of I campus. His visit here is sponsored in part by the U of I Global Studies Initiative. So other opportunities to hear from him. And if you're interested in reading about the subject, going into the history of cotton, going back some way. We focused here this morning on kind of on what's going on today with cotton. But if you'd like to know more about its history internationally and what it has meant to the United States, that is what you'll find in the book. It's titled Big Cotton, and it's published by Viking, and it came out at the beginning of the year, so you shouldn't have any trouble finding it, by our guest, Stephen Yaffa. Thank you very much.
David, thank you.
We appreciate it. The broadcast today is made possible with support from Owens Funeral Home at the corner of Elm and University in Champaign. Locally owned and operated, serving families since 1925, Owens Funeral Home invites you to join them in supporting public radio. We do, here on WILL, have the support of many businesses, and throughout the day you hear their names mentioned. It would be great if we could mention the names of all of the individuals who support the station, but that would take up an awful lot of time. So why don't we just start out here by saying thanks. If you're a supporter of WILL, we thank you. We could not do what we do without you. We also want to reach out, though, to folks who listen. Maybe you've been listening for a while and you're not a financial supporter. We need you, too. More than ever, we need the support of all of the people who listen to WILO. And we're talking about financial support here. We're not just talking about moral support. We're talking about money. We're talking about people calling us, calling 244-9455, and making a pledge of financial support to this station. Jack Brighton oversees our web operations and is often heard as host here on Focus 580. Why should people do this?
Well, because it's important. It's something that, you know, gives you a lot. I mean, the last interview, the interview of the last hour, very interesting ideas, new information, perspective that you just don't get other places. I mean, this is disappearing from radio, actually from the media in general, and we keep it going here. This is a place for really hard thinking, which we think is really important. But we don't want you to think too hard before you pick up the telephone. All you have to do to help support this is call us at 244-9455. One of the most amazing things that it always strikes me when we talk about this is 9 out of 10 people who listen to the show don't support it. And we do want you to listen, but we also want you to take that extra step and give us a call. And right now especially, because we have a couple challenges going that will add quite a bit to any pledge you make during Focus 580 today. David Teal is our TV program director, and he is in our pledge center. And Dave, it's a little bit complicated. Can you sort of explain what's going on and where we stand?
Well, we have, as you said, a couple of challenges and an additional incentive, which we'll talk about in a moment here. The first challenge, this is for Focus 580 this morning. So we only have another hour to go on this. We have a champagne couple who will add $25 to each pledge, up to a total of 10 pledges. So that is for new or renewing members of the Friends of WILL. There is a second challenge from Bert Gray of Decatur. He will add $20 to each new member of the Friends of WILL, up again to a total of 10. So right there's $450 on the line. Now, the fact of the matter is, we didn't get any calls for Focus back here during this last hour.
Well, that's interesting.
You know, people were calling into the program. They weren't calling back here. Now, we did get a couple of calls for the Ag Service early in the hour. And you know, of course, that last hour, I mean, it shows, I mean, I think people are very passionate about agriculture issues here. And so we hope that if they appreciated the last hour programming, they will call us right now at 217-244-9455 and get in on those challenges, because we really especially want to retire the one that's specifically for Focus. That's so $250.
Right. So basically, if you've never pledged before, if you call 244-9455 with your basic membership pledge right now, $40 for an annual membership. It'll also, add $45 additional to your pledge.
That's correct.
That's right. So we hope. Oh, do that right now. 244-9455.
Just quickly, too. There's one other incentive. New Friends of WILL. If you've never made a pledge before, you can receive a $10 gift certificate courtesy of World Harvest Foods, and that's in addition to the other challenges this morning. So please call now.
Thank you, guys. We're going to take a break here, as we usually do when Focus continues in the next hour. We will be talking with a film scholar, a Canadian film scholar. His name is Murray Pomerantz, who's written a lot about American films. He's written about Alfred Hitchcock. He has a new book out that's all about the actor Johnny Depp. We'll talk a little bit about current films and their actors with Murray Pomerantz coming up in the next part of the show. First, though, we will take a break for news and update on the market. Stay tuned.
Good morning, everyone. This is Dave Dickey with a look at the markets. At the Chicago Board of Trade, the corn pit is mixed this morning in a very light volume trade. Traders and analysts are saying that although demand remains good, the big supply of feed grains continue to dampen bullish enthusiasm for corn futures. Yesterday, USDA revised its estimate.